Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I am Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
We have an industry pro with us today.
We do. We are always surprised by that. It's like, oh my gosh, we actually have one with us.
That's because people keep talking to us. And that's weird.
One day they'll learn.
They will learn, maybe one day. Anyway, our guest today is Scott Hartzman. How are you doing today, Scott?
Good. Thank you very much. How y'all doing?
I mean, it's a Monday.
Which, I'm told that. I have no other,
measure. It's been one big, long day, yeah. Really. That's what...
2020 has been now 2 decades.
This is horrible. Yeah. Stop saying that. I don't like it. So, more info about Scott. Scott has been executive producing MMOs for many years, including Rift and EverQuest 2. He's developed and produced over 30 MMOs. That is amazing.
That's a big number.
It's been a little while. Yeah, we were doing massive online games before the MMO word even was a word, and it's been nothing but the best.
That's awesome. That's great. I can't wait to talk to you about this. And we've obviously worked together a bunch in the past. Mm-hmm. We have been colleagues. I've covered Tryon. Manda has interviewed you in the past. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We thought that it would be great to talk with you given your extensive experience in running live games.
Sure.
We're in some weird times right now.
Really, really weird times.
Yeah.
And, well, first, how are you faring with the weirdness?
I gotta say, it's been, this is supposed to be the season, right? When everybody in the games industry comes out of winter hibernation and then convention season happens and you get to see all of your friends, and with all of that not happening this year. And then on top of that, it's almost like the world is on pause, right?
Yeah.
So it is, we're doing fine. But yeah, it is a singular time right now. And it's been, it's definitely been a thing watching the world kind of adapt to it.
And that's why it's been a really interesting process for the two of us, especially because we've been having all of these conversations with industry professionals. And that tends to be the echo that we're hearing is, look, it's not business as usual. But it also needs to be as close to business as usual as possible.
So one of the big changes that has been going on right now is work from home. Mm-hmm. We've got, everybody in the industry now is working from home. And for some people, that's not a big deal. For freelancers, not a big change, except, work is drying up. For some media outlets that have a remote profile, GamesBeat is remote. Jeff's in Colorado, for instance. There are publishers that are remote. Raw Fury, Devolver, they work kind of remotely as well.
But they've got their like Devolver has their little hub in Austin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've got some companies that were able to make this adjustment more easily. But we have a lot of companies, a lot of larger companies especially, that don't typically have large work from home profiles.
Right.
And especially when you're talking about companies that run live games.
Yes.
This is a big change. So just to set the table, you've run a number of live games.
Yeah.
What is involved on a day-to-day basis for keeping those games active, live, people able to connect to them, all that sort of thing?
Yeah. So think about it in like three categories. You've got the people that are making the game, the people that are operating the game, and the people that are, dealing with partnerships and publishing and marketing and all of that. So for the people that are operating the game, this is probably the least amount of disturbance, because these things are running 24/7 anyway. So you tend to have a large number of people that are already used to doing remote work, to keep games running. When problems happen at 2 a.m., it's everybody hopping into Slack, Skype, Discord, whatever, to talk through a problem. You've got partnership people who, some of them can be, there tend to be a larger number of remote people in that area because they're outside, dealing with the external world. So it's not probably not that huge of a disruption for them. Now, the people actually making the game, though, that's where things start to get hairy, mm-hmm. where, you know, they're, you know, in all of the studios that I've either worked at or run, you definitely have people that are used to doing some amount of work from home, but not in an every single day, you know, this is the new normal type situation. You know, games are made up of assets, you know, not just source code, but visual files, you know, art files, audio files, voice, and those are large. And home internet is not as good as office internet. So having to pull all of that stuff down every day can be, you know, can definitely be a strain. It can take a lot of time. It can be slow. It can be really, it can slow your life down. So yeah, it's, you know, definitely a fair bit of change as people trying to make games in particular are having to adjust to this.
I would imagine that even just beyond the internet connection, not having that face-to-face time to be collaborating in spaces mm-hmm. together, to be not just building the game itself, like in, you know, coding it and rigging models and everything like that, but actually staying connected to one another to keep that creative flow going. I can imagine that is so difficult to do in virtual spaces.
It is, and it's it tends to be a cultural thing at studios. You know, when you have a strong culture built up around the idea of, you know, grabbing a conference room, having a meeting, mm-hmm. Incidental contact, bouncing ideas off each other in the halls. You know, people tend to build cultures around those kinds of interactions. And you know, when I talk to friends that are starting studios these days, you know, more of them are doing all remote all the time. And I think it is a real boon if you're building that in from the ground up,
sure.
because from somebody who's tried, it is not easy to graft on to an existing culture.
Do you think that we're going to see people eager to return to the status quo for companies that are typically centralized and on-site? Or do you think that we're going to see some additional flexibility about remote after everybody's been through this?
You know, I don't think it's going to be universal either way. You know, if I had to guess, I would say 50-50. Especially when you're talking about places like, so I'm in the Bay Area. A lot of people have very long commutes. And so I'm fairly certain that one thing that's going to happen is people are going to realize they can be productive members of society without having to ditch 2 hours a day sitting in their car. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that you're going to hear more people like that going, you know, this whole remote thing is pretty great. How much more can... at the same time, you have people who may not have the physical space at home to work comfortably, may have too many distractions. And, you know, I had one friend who pulled me aside for so we could do lunch over Google Hangouts video chat with each other, because to him, he was one day at home and was already just losing his shit. And he was just, you know, he was just done. And he's like, I need contact. I crave contact. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I'm going crazy here. So I think you're going to see a bunch of different responses, but I definitely think there's going to be a greater push toward more remote than we've seen in the past.
I think what's interesting though is, and I hope, because this isn't normal remote, if you have kids,
yeah,
I guess, yeah. If you have kids, this is not normal remote.
No, it's
because
not.
Because they're home,
yeah,
and it's like summer break, except mm-hmm. they can't go to the pool. And they have to be at their desks, so to speak, whether that's yep. an actual desk or the dining room table like it is here. And they have to be learning and they need supervision, especially when you have a 7 and 8 year old.
Yeah.
They are
where they need Professor Mom.
They need Professor Mom. Mm-hmm. Amanda is an excellent Professor Mom. I don't know if I'd be as good a Professor Mom as Amanda.
Could put the Morticia wig on you.
We
I
could
guess.
Put the Morticia wig on me. I think I would look stellar.
I agree.
Check out my Instagram, I guess, soon.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, we were referring to this over here as, you know, the most unwelcome Christmas break that we've ever had. Because it kind of has that feel to it
uh-huh.
where, you know, games industry is notorious for doing the, you know, the time off between Christmas and New Year's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, to me, going back as far as my career starting, was the time of year I super looked forward to. Because it was the only time I could not work and not feel guilty about it. because the entire industry was shut down.
Big,
right?
Move.
Everything is shut down. Yes, you need to deal with live game emergencies, but hopefully, you know, the world, you know, doesn't conspire to give you any that week, and you actually get to take a breath. However, this is like unwelcome pause, where nobody really wants to pause, but we're all forced to.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about some of the ways that running a live service game really differs from just shipping a game as a product.
Sure, sure. There's definitely, you know, I could fill up hours and hours about that. But,
oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've never done that I have a lot of friends that work in single player games and have worked in single player games for a long time. And one dynamic that always mystified me was the act of shipping a game, everybody exhales, and then people go off on vacation for a month, right? You know, and that's when all the comp time gets paid out, and that's when people get to breathe. Because when you're running a game, the thing, you know, a live game, the biggest thing to keep in mind is that, you know, you're developing the game, it feels hard, you're going to alpha, it, you know, gets 20% harder, you go to beta, it gets 100% harder, you go to live, and it gets 100% harder. The work really starts then. And every time it ramps up, you're not sure how you're going to be able to handle it, but somehow you make it through. Both of ours has said that, every shipped game there, you know, there is its own series of miracles. And that is doubly true with online live services. Because once you're running, it's now this, you know, this living, breathing service platform that needs new content. It needs bug fixes. It needs live events. It needs customer service. You know, it needs all of these things that require human beings. There's a lot of people required to keep these things running.
Well, let's break that down into those, because I think those are important silos or important buckets to put the conversations around live service in. Can you just talk a little bit about how an operations team works together to respond, to collect bug and outage reports, to respond to those bug and outage reports, and then to implement, to diagnose and implement fixes for them, and what that's like when everybody is co-located in the office?
Yeah, I mean, one of the nice things about, you know, online games is that you kind of get set up for remote for that aspect from the get-go. If you're going to do anything at scale, you already have dashboards that everybody can see on any device, you know, on their phone, on their home PC. You have alerts flying out over texts, over, you know, Slack bots, over, you know, XMPP and IRC bots in some, you know, in some companies, to where there's always a notification mechanic. And then there's a series of procedures that people use to respond. So generally what you have is you have your frontline people doing the monitoring, which is, you know, people will refer to as the NOC or the Network Operations Center. We worked with a partner in Eastern Europe for that. And, you know, we had them watching during our night and we had our local people watching during our day. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, we were already used to being very remote much of the time because these people are working opposite times. They're talking, you know, somebody's at home all the time and so on. So usually, you know, one of those groups will notice a trouble of some type has happened. And from then, you know, from there, it's a matter of figuring out what is the type of trouble. Is it a player drop that is caused by a network provider suddenly doing a maintenance or suddenly having an outage? Mm-hmm. Is it caused by a DDoS attack? Is it the actual software has run into, you know, some kind of problem? And once you figure out if it's the software, is it your publisher, you know, is it, you know, your publishing platform or publishing partner, or is it your own game that's having a problem? And, you know, those things need to be investigated. And then that group is the front line. And then they raise, you know, they raise the flag to the rest of the operations group, as well as the team that needs to, that is expected to need to respond. And then, you know, that team immediately hops onto their computers, no matter where they are, and begins trying to diagnose what the problem is. You know, they verify, is the problem what people are saying it is? Because that's not always the case. You know, so they need to verify that. You know, and then is this a thing that we need new software for? You know, should we be getting into emergency fixes and emergency builds and emergency diagnostics? Or is this something where, it's a hardware swap. It's a, just wait out the network provider. So all of these, all of these different trouble diagnostics have different avenues of resolution, and the different avenues of resolution all have levels of impact on, you and your players. You know, the difference between, we need to let the ISP flip a switch versus we need to call developers in to have them diagnose, build software, call QA in to have software QA'd, have the new software stage on a live test server to verify that it works there, and then have it staged out to live. That's about as invasive as it can get. So yeah, there's a, a huge array of problems that can happen. And what you'll tend to find is that for each type of problem, over time, a runbook of solutions and processes tends to get built, because you really, when a problem happens at 3 a.m., the last thing you want is tired people making stuff up on the fly. You want them going down, it's the Apollo 11 checklist, right? It's, you've got the big binder, you've got the list of things that you do, because you want to make as much of that muscle memory as possible.
That makes a lot of sense. But especially in the case of, say there is some kind of hardware failure, something goes wrong with the server bank somewhere, how is this complicated by being forced to work from home as opposed to opting to work from home?
So that's an interesting one, is because a lot of companies are already working remote at that and have been for the last 10 years, if not longer. So back when we were, when I was working on the first EverQuest, the data center was in the downstairs of the studio. So that, in that era, we weren't remote. A couple of years later, we took all of those games to external data centers anyway. And when you have games that are in external data centers, one of the services you're paying for is remote hands. And so that is, you hopefully have your stash of extra hardware, your swap hardware, in case something does go bad. You call the remote hands people and say, hey, we've got a problem on, server X, in slot Y. We need you to go swap the hardware and then let us know when it's done, and we'll remote reformat it and reinstall everything from here. So there, for stuff like that, there's already a lot of precedent and procedure for how to deal with it remotely.
So it sounds like then reporting and diagnostics, and in terms of keeping a game's uptime in those high percentages that players expect, as long as it's not a new software issue, things should be pretty good.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons that we've ever been able to take the Christmas break as reliably as we have, is that in general, as long as you're not introducing new software, you should be able to deal with, a couple of weeks of low impact operation. The one exception to that is, if you look at where we are today, you have all of these online services that are setting new records. It's because when I was talking about, the unwelcome Christmas break, this is, unwelcome Christmas break on crack, because you have, Steam is setting new records, new CCU records every single day. Something like this is unprecedented. And so what you're going to see is some of those systems are going to be able to handle the extra load just fine. Others may hit a break point where suddenly, oh crap, now we do have emergency live problems to solve, for scale that we weren't expecting to deal with.
And, I think we saw some of that right at the beginning. Xbox Live was having trouble. The Nintendo eShop and the online services were having trouble. Steam hit record concurrence, and it usually does hit those During Christmas break. Christmas is usually, you're right, this is the stuff we see during Christmas break, and usually that's as a result of new hardware coming online.
Especially
on the console side.
It's new hardware. It's every single gamer in the world is, has that same 2 weeks off, so everybody's getting online. One of the things that I am, kind of curious about is how many people during this are picking up gaming simply because they're just kind of out of other stuff to do. So I'm wondering, how much load is going to come in from new people that weren't even part of, the previous holiday loads, and how are we going to, how are we going to absorb that?
The really interesting thing that I've seen, and this is anecdotal only,
yeah,
is that I'm seeing more parents around, you know, around our neighborhood are starting to either reinstall old consoles that they've had sitting in basements for a while for the kids, for them, so that they can be doing something. I mean, our eldest daughter has been talking about picking up single player games and playing them in our spare bedroom because she can't go out and see her friends. She's an extremely social person. So she's like, okay, but what if I went and hung out on PlayStation and my friends play like Lego Batman? And what if I played like Horizon Zero Dawn or something?
Mm-hmm.
And Grace is not a gamer. Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean,
she's a social gamer. She's the gamer version of a social drinker. And I say that when all seriousness.
No, that's true. It's true.
Like she played Fortnite when she had a boyfriend who played Fortnite.
Yes, exactly. So she'll play games if her friends are playing games, and that's totally fine. She's kind of our she's our outlier in the family because the three youngest kids are just like always playing video games.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
That's their favorite thing to do. So yes, I think that, you know, anecdotally speaking, just observing even things going on in the Twitter sphere where folks are like, okay, I haven't like fellow journalists that don't work in tech and they don't work in games. So lifestyle journalists and folks working in politics and stuff like that. They're like, yeah, I went and dug out my old PlayStation and I'm like playing PlayStation 2 games.
There was a Times article today. And I don't love the framing, but it was, you know, it's like, you know, people are like, it's okay to play video games right now. There's no reason to be ashamed. It's like, there's never a reason to be ashamed about playing video games, but
it's
okay,
really
Times, you do
okay.
You. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's
okay, Gloomer.
Yeah, okay, Gloomer.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, when you look at the fact that, you know, human beings, a lot of us do go out for friends, you know, or go out with friends. We go out for lunch. We go out for dinner. We go out for drinks.
Yep.
You can't do that now. And so I can definitely see that with kids, especially where, you know, they're definitely, you can only watch so much Netflix, right?
Mm-hmm.
She is proving that. By the way,
she really is. She's like, she loves her comedies and her horror movies, but she doesn't watch horror movies by herself anymore. She's gotten into the really heavy stuff.
I think she's digested every comedy special on Netflix, which you should hear some of the things.
Yeah.
She turned 16 and suddenly she's got a real potty mouth.
A little bit. Small bit. That's also your fault.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah. A little bit. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about things like rolling out updates, patches, hot fixes. You know, we talked about the challenges of working from home in terms of the internet. How does that affect things like rolling out a hot patch or a hot fix or a patch or an update to a game?
Yeah, I mean, so much of that has to do with the what does it take to develop and QA it and verify it properly. Mm-hmm. The act of rolling it out, once that's all been done, is something that is actually shockingly remote friendly. The challenging part of it is the developing and building, and so much of that comes down to, you know, there it's really two big aspects. It's number one, it's the asset size. Mm-hmm. In order to, you know, the way game development branches tend to work for these types of games is, you know, you have a main branch, which is a full, you know, effectively the full authoritative source of truth of, you know, the current version of the game that's in progress. You have a separate branch for your QA group that things get promoted to. Then you have a separate branch for your live test, you know, or PTS or live test server. You then have a separate branch that you probably use just to stage up what a live build is going to be so you can make sure that you're testing live before it hits live. And then you have the live branch. Let's say you have a game that's like 40 gigs all packed up. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we just now get to multiply that by 5. And then you have all of the source art and source assets of everything, you know, whether it's big, you know, massive, multiple 100 megabyte Photoshop files, whether it's raw WAV files for, you know, for audio, you know, that can total up over, you know, into the terabytes range. So these are not small things to sync down remotely to a home computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's pretend, you know, and most people will figure out how to solve that by just pulling down what they need in order to keep things reasonably sane. But so once you have that and you're building a fix and you're working on your own, you know, your own local server that you're building on your own desktop machine, then there's the getting QA, you know, making sure that QA can then look at it by putting it on a shared server that they can, you know, that they can test. Mm-hmm. And then once that's all done, that's when like the live operations side of the business tends to take over, where, you know, you drop off the package and the ops pros are the ones who, they get it into their hopper, they get patches out to the patch servers. They're the ones that, at least in my experience, are already the most used to working remotely. Because for them, it's, they're pushing assets around between different servers where you don't have these crazy bandwidth considerations. And in a lot of cases, they're already working on remote sites, or they're working from home as they're doing this at weird hours. And so
that sounds like IT, all right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like the internet, it's the internet as a whole largely only works, and largely only worked many years ago, because there were network directors and network operators from all of these various ISPs that would sit together in the same IRC channel and talk about all of their problems. And so it, that culture largely got absorbed into online games operations culture, because in some cases, it's the same people. So they're already used to, look, pushing data around from boxes to data center to data center. So yeah, that, like, and so given that, in one of the games launches we did, we actually did multiple of our beta launches without having anybody in the office. And this was, you know, we were doing this as far back as 10 years ago. And, you know, and it's something that if you can get good at launching these games remotely and, you know, updating these games remotely, it will pay off for you when you have, you know, the 3 a.m. phone call.
Got it. There's one thing that you said I want to kind of zero in on.
Yeah.
And this comes from a personal experience that we had yesterday, where one of our sons broke his laptop.
Oh dear.
Trying to replace any technology right now is challenging. How are companies equipping developers who are not used to working from home and may not have massive amounts of storage on their home computers? I assume that they probably do have decent personal technology from a computational standpoint, but maybe aren't fully equipped in a way that you would expect an office network to be.
Yeah, I mean, that is a fantastic question. Because like, when you look at, there's a bunch of stuff that you just can't take for granted. And it goes all the way back with, do you have physical space at home where you can actually be productive? And then once you get past that, you're exactly right. It's okay, well, whose computer are you going to be using? And what are the factors that are going to drive that decision? Number one, do you even have one at home that you can use? One of the things that I've seen some companies doing is literally just telling their developers, look, just take your work PC home with you, right? That way you're guaranteed to have all of your stuff. You know, you're already, you know, you can already use it and it'll be fine. But then there's other companies that are more security focused where, you know, they require, you know, the company's hardware, encrypted hard drives, everything done only VPN all the time. You know, and because we do, you know, live in an era where even without any of the current issues going on, there, you know, is an increasing danger of outside attacks, outside hack attempts, and so on. And so, you know, there's a lot of highly justified paranoia out there. I have to imagine that if I'm a security IT department at one of the big publishers right now,
nightmares.
No remote. Right. I mean, this is like the World Series, the Olympics, and, you know, and a bombing all rolled into one for groups like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you don't have that stash of laptops, chances are, you know, or, you know, high powered laptops or desktops to share, chances are you might be delayed in getting them. And what does that do? So yeah, there's a lot that's got to go into it, right? Oh no, I'm right here.
Okay.
You went super silent for a sec.
Oh, sorry. And I guess there's one other aspect I can mention of that too, is that with VPNs, you know, with the virtual private network clients that we all use for security, those, you know, a typical game developer that has people in the office for most of their jobs probably has a few dozen VPN users on a daily basis. Suddenly that expands out to 100% of the, you know, of the staff, you know, where you now need to deal with, you know, 200, 300, 400, a couple thousand VPN users. those things aren't cheap. That's hardware, you know, that's hardware of its own, that's licensing of its own, and that's traffic of its own to deal with. And so that, I'm sure there's going to be some companies that are feeling the squeeze on that right now.
Yeah, I hadn't even considered that. But yeah, now that my dad's a network administrator, so I'm assuming that he is like sweating bullets right now.
Yeah.
Working with some, because he works with a lot of smaller businesses.
Yeah.
Mostly in tourism in my hometown. But this is all stuff that he has to deal with on a regular basis on a smaller scale. I can't even imagine what that looks like on a larger scale. And seriously, now that I'm thinking about this from the security perspective, now I'm sweating bullets.
Yeah. Because that's your, once you have people pulling down all of your source code to your game, possibly your game engine, probably your game engine, and all of the source art, you know, all it takes is one of those laptops to get into the wrong hands. And now suddenly, you know, congratulations, somebody can launch a pirate server and customize client and build it forever for your game.
Wow.
Which is largely how a lot of the pirate servers for games did come about, is that somewhere in the asset chain, somebody got hacked, and all of that stuff got swooped. And it's scary.
So just to put a fine point on it, then we've seen a couple of, before WoW went vanilla, there were a couple of vanilla servers that went up that were pirated, that were, you know, run illegally. Your thought is that was potentially due to hacking where somebody got the source code?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about WoW's. You know, they could have reversed like some of the earlier emulators did. I know that for one of the games that we published, we didn't get hacked and have it stolen, but one of the other regional publishers did get hacked, and that was how the package got stolen. Oh. And that was what prompted a series of emulated servers that are still running to this day, in fact. Yeah.
Yikes.
Yep.
So we've covered like normal operations, keeping the game live.
Yep.
We talked about hot fixes, and we've generally talked about patches and updates and how that whole process works. I think the big question for me that comes at the end of it is, given what we know about people's at-home conditions, especially if there are kids involved, and those kids are home right now and doing remote learning and may need some additional care.
Uh-huh.
That productivity due to those factors, compounded with potentially people who aren't accustomed, like we work well from home, but other people don't know how to stay focused, and that's not a knock on them. It's just,
no, certainly not.
You know, if you've never done it before,
it's a muscle. You have to build that working from home muscle, and it takes a long time to really suss out what it is, what habits are going to be best for you. But Mike and I have been doing this for
a decade.
10 years.
Sure. Yeah.
So I guess my question is twofold. One is, are we likely to see a slowdown in new updates? And then as a follow-up, if the answer to that is yes, given that usership is under normal circumstances, and this is under normal circumstances, based upon a cadence of updates and reasons for people to come back, what is the potential long-term effect of all of these changes?
You're talking on MAUs?
Revenue, MAUs, you know, if there was a major update that was going to bring new new cosmetics, or if there was a major, like, expansion that was planned going to get knocked down the road, what are we potentially looking at over the long term? Or is this just going to be a blip, and then once, who knows when this is going to be, everything gets back to normal, are we going to see a more rapid normalization?
I think that, you know, any impact in the short term is going to be minimal, because anything that's shipping in the short term has, you know, been through its development, you know, through the past weeks and months, and is just now being finalized, right? So, you know, anything that ships soon has been worked on for a while. Anything that is supposed to ship in the next couple of months has probably already been planned reasonably thoroughly, and, you know, people are executing, you know, and they're just having to adjust to doing it from a different place. The place where it's going to get more, you know, more uncertain is, you know, things that are just now beginning to get planned by companies that everybody is now working remote, where they have no experience in doing so, right? that's where the big challenges are going to be. And you're absolutely going to see delays. Truth be told, though, you know, compared to local small businesses, I am so not worried about games companies right now.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, the online games, that's the thing we all can be doing.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So I think that online games right now, the last thing they need to be worried about is, you know, keeping the microtransaction flow going. You know, buy a gift card to a local restaurant instead, right? I'd rather, you know, see support going that way. Online games, I think, are, you know, uniquely positioned to do, you know, extremely well during this unfortunate crisis. So, and I think that, you know, if you assume that there are more people playing games, more people monetizing games, they can afford to slow down, they can afford to slow down a bit and adjust.
Right. That's a fantastic way to look at things. And I agree. I mean, we talked about last week the ripple effect. In fact, that was when Stephanie Tinsley was on, we talked about how things are hitting the game industry, but they're hitting in such, it's like dropping a boulder into a lake and these huge ripples coming out, and those things that are getting hit are restaurants. It's service workers. And you know, I just
contract workers.
You know, I just want to take a moment. Like, if there's one thing I want people to take away from this show and our work, and it has nothing to do with games, quite frankly. It's if you need to be out and about right now and you are encountering people who are putting themselves in harm's way every day, that's people who are stocking shelves at supermarkets, that's people who are, you know, delivering food for restaurants, you know,
just working in technology.
Yeah.
You know, that's also a really big one. I mean, Best Buy has been deemed an essential service, you know, so if you're, you know, hats off to your local geek squad.
Yeah. Be kind. Like, that's the thing I want people to take away. It's just be kind always, but especially now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, like one of the things that's, I wasn't surprised to hear at all, and I'm sure you all heard it too, you know, Amazon announcing last week that they're looking to emergency hire 100,000 employees simply to keep up with deliveries. And I don't know about your area, but our area right now, they have zero ability to fulfill new delivery orders for, you know, for things like groceries.
Yep.
So,
we're seeing the same thing.
Yeah,
I mean, the system is beyond stressed. The system is at the bursting point. So yes, being kind to the people that are keeping it running, I think, is everybody's, you know, that's like the low bar, right? Be extra nice to the people that are keeping us all alive. No, that's the absolute low bar, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then taking that to the game angle, which is if your favorite service or game goes down for a little bit, take a breath.
Yeah.
And like it'll be back. Just know that people are doing their best right now.
Yeah. And everybody is, of course, you know, everybody who supports all of these things is absolutely obsessing over them right now. It's not like anybody it's not like anybody is going, oh, I guess I don't have to pay attention to my live game that's keeping us all employed. they're absolutely obsessing over it. And I'm sure they're concerned about their own diminished capacity to respond. And so, you know, they want to make sure that they're doing the best for the players that they can at all times, and it's just challenging right now. Yeah,
absolutely.
And by the way, I also need to mention, I think y'all thing and getting Steph for your first show, I don't know if you know, we worked together on Rift's launch, and she was fantastic. So I'm glad you all got to talk.
Yeah, Steph's great.
It was a fun conversation.
It was a lot of expletives.
It is the one episode that is marked as explicit.
Yeah, it was great, though. We cussed a lot. It was fun.
Right on.
We always have a good time talking to Steph.
That's cool.
But Scott, thank you so much for sitting down with us today and discussing such an important topic. And, you know, we look forward to having you back to talk about, you know, stuff that isn't about the pandemic once the pandemic is not a pandemic anymore.
I look forward to all of us making it through this in one piece, coming out the other side and going, well, that was crazy, wasn't it?
that was nuts. Let's go for dinner, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let us not socially distance.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. The extroverts are we hungry for human interaction.
I understand. Well, at least you can virtually get your game on in the meanwhile.
That's very, very true.
I definitely hope the best for y'all.
Oh, and thank you. And definitely likewise. So thank you so much for joining us today. We are definitely still putting out a call for indies to come and hang out with us. Tell us about your game.
Yep, we'd love to do more indie spotlights. In order for us to do indie spotlights, we need
to know you exist.
Yes, so please feel free to DM us.
This is like games that are in development, mm-hmm. that are seeking funding, publishing opportunities. This is also for games that have been recently released and might have gotten swept under a rug somehow, or, you know, you're looking to release soon and you want to generate a little bit of extra buzz. As long as you're an indie developer, we are here for you.
Absolutely. Just shoot us a DM at virtualeconcast or send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
Mike, we have more guests this week.
We do.
People keep wanting to talk to us.
It's beautiful. We are making the conscious decision, though, to scale back just a little bit. We hit the ground running. We did a show every day last week. It was a lot. We are doing 3 shows this week right now. I say right now because you never know what's going to happen. On late Wednesday night, we are talking with Walt Williams, who is the narrative designer for Star Wars Battlefront 2 and Spec Ops The Line. That show will air on Thursday because we're not going to edit it late on Wednesday night. No. That wouldn't be fair to us or to you because, boy, we would be tired.
I think it wouldn't get out until like midnight. Yeah. And at that point, no thank you.
Yes.
And on Friday, we are having a conversation with Eva Carr. She's the founder of Hey Glitch. They hang out. They're out in Minneapolis. Cool. Eva and I had a chance to have a great conversation when I was at the Game Developers of Color Expo out in Harlem last year. So I'm really excited to talk to Eva about some of the things that Glitch is doing, the ways that they're supporting indies, and having a conversation about the ways in which this is continuing to affect indie developers and, in this case, indie publishers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that about does it for this episode of Virtual Economy. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconcast. I am @Footerish, FUTTERISH, and...
I'm @AmandaFarrow.
And Scott, where can people find you online?
I'm @Hartsman.
Excellent.
On Twitter.
On the hell site of Twitter.
The hell site.
The beautiful hell site. That's not even our language. That's Matt Piscatello's language. You can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's LIBSYN.com/RSS. But we're also on all major platforms now.
We did it.
We're legit.
Yeah.
We're actually
congratulations.
Legit.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
So we're on Spotify, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Google Play, we're on Stitcher, we're on Overcast, you can't escape us.
If we are not on your favorite podcast listening service, though, hit us up on Twitter and we'll go investigate in how we can fix that.
Because we're still figuring out which platforms we need to be on. The only platform that we are not actively on right now is SoundCloud, and that is a conscious choice.
Yes. please do review the show if you are listening on a platform that sports reviews, because that helps.
And also, subscriptions help. So if you're on Apple Podcasts and Google Play or on Spotify, if you subscribe, it lets the algorithm know that, hey, we're worth paying attention to. So let's tell that algorithm what's what.
Yeah. Got questions for us or for one of our guests? Please do DM us at @VirtualEconcast or send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
So we'll be back soon. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, be good to one another.